Okay, the time is 8:33 a.m. on July 21st, 2020, and I'm convening this video conference meeting of the Board of the Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act, the governor's suspension of the certain Open Meeting Act requirements due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and the association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on July 10th, 2020 and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. A copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved as all nine of the directors are present. Also in attendance are Board Counsel Shelby Betts, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, Executive Director Bart Bowles, and Association Employees Jarrett Terry and Topping Haggerty. And from the Texas Department of Insurance are John Alexander, John Peters, Tina Arendall, James Kennedy, Brian Wewe, and Patty Otto. Anybody else join us? Nope. So, on to item one. Consideration and possible action on consent agenda items. Does anybody have any minutes issues?
No.
Well, we have a consent agenda resolution.
I'll move the resolution. Second.
That was Jim Harrison and James Huckabee?
Yes.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Anybody opposed? Thank you very much. And we're moving on to the Department of Insurance. Bart wasn't aware of anything you wanted to say in open session, but has something changed?
Hey, thanks, Jim, and I just want to say good morning to everyone. The only message I would share is the same one from last time. Under these challenging situations and conditions, the TDI continues to operate effectively and efficiently while we continue to work remotely from the office. Each month, the commissioner and others are assessing the situation, keeping the staff informed, and we get advance notice that while we as staff of TDI should continue to look and prepare for a time when we would return to the office, conditions are such that we will not be doing that in July and not for August as well. So taking it month by month, but managing well just the same. So that's the message from TDI this morning.
Okay, so that was item number two. We can move on to item number three with regards to the continued implementation of the COVID-19 pandemic response plan. Bart, I'm guessing you're up.
Yes, as you're aware, the fiscal offices of the association remain closed. We closed them March 13th, have not reopened. Jarrett and Topping both are occasionally in the office to do certain things. Topping taking the primary load to make sure all the physical mail that might come into the office is managed. So with that, we had originally discussed maybe reopening the offices June 15th, and we talked about July 6th. We've now taken a target date off the table. We're not even going to talk about reopening the offices until things turn around a little. And right now, the COVID situation in Austin is terrible. And so we are continuing to work remotely. Staff has all the equipment they need to work remotely. We are making a change. A voice over IP phone system is being shifted. Actually, most of the numbers are porting today from Univerge Blue, which is the NEC cloud communications platform, to Ring Central. And then on Thursday, our fax number, which is tied to an analog line provided by AT&T, will be going digital, and it will port from AT&T also to Ring Central. So the new phone system can be operated from a desktop or from soft phones on the desk, and actually can be operated from a cellular phone. So we have full office functionality with fax, transferring calls within our regular phone numbers and our toll-free and our main local number. So our phone system has been limited until now. And the good thing is moving your Ring Central with some of the other services we can drop, the costs are exactly the same, if not a slight savings. So you should not see any difference, but our direct dial numbers that we've not been using for the last 4 months will be back in operation later this week. I will report at the last board meeting, the board discussed the Paycheck Protection Program under the CARES Act, that the association had received a loan under that program. And that loan was, the application submitted April 9th, funded in April 10th. During its April 21st meeting, the board asked me to go ahead and implement either repayment or rescission of that loan through Chase Bank, which was the originator. I did that, and on April 22nd, we repaid that loan and $31.18 of interest. So the day after the board meeting, your instructions were carried out. So that is done. And as far as future planning of our response to COVID, we're being very cautious about how we proceed, but I've mentioned the phone system. We're looking at other operations we might need. And I'll talk later about our office space when we get to the executive director report. And I think that's everything on the COVID report. Jim?
Okay.
Jim,
thanks for moving. Oh, go ahead.
Board, on your payback, Chase, that's April 22nd, 2020, on page 3.2. This is smart.
Right. That should say 2020. That's a typo slip. Yeah. Okay. You get extra points, and those will be awarded after the meeting.
All right. Very good.
I have to accumulate them because there will be others.
And then we're on to item 4, which is the personnel committee.
Okay. This is Robin. So the personnel committee met yesterday, and we had several things that we discussed. The first thing we did was we reviewed the RFP responses for the engagement of a compensation consulting firm, and there were 5 responses that had been received, and each one of the personnel committee members reviewed them. We did a score sheet, and we gave it to Bart so he could compile all of our responses. Am I supposed to announce now who we've basically decided to award the RFP to, or does that have to be done in executive session?
No, that can be done now. Okay. You can make that. I would just say make that and go through the rest of the reports, and then let's address all the resolutions at the end of your report.
Okay. So, the proposal that was selected was Clifton Larson Allen. That was the best proposal meeting specifications that was received. And does anybody else want to say anything further on that before we move on to the next? James or David or Bart?
You're doing a great job, Robin.
Okay. Just that
it was unanimous even before we conferred. All of us had ranked them as the number one choice.
Yeah, it was unanimous. They were definitely the best proposal that was received. So we're sure that they're going to do a great job for us in that regard. We also
just a technical note, Robin, before you continue. That is a recommendation from the committee.
Yeah.
now, and the board does need to, pass a resolution to that effect, which I believe is part of the resolutions that you've got as well.
Yeah. Okay. And then we also talked about the non-salary benefits provided to the association's employees, including insurance plan renewals. Now, this does not require board action. Bart has full authority to handle those renewals, and he had gotten quotes. He reviewed those with the personnel committee, and we were all in agreement that his recommendations were in the best interest of the employees and the association. So did we want to go further into that? Do y'all need to know the details?
If I could, Robin, I'll just report. The renewals we received, a slight increase in the renewal on our health insurance plan from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, but we're very comfortable with that plan, and the renewal premium increase was minor. So we are going to renew that. The change that I recommended, or that I am intending to take and want to make sure the committee didn't have any concern, is to move our dental coverage, our group life and AD&D, and our long-term disability from Sun Life to Lincoln Financial. Lincoln's quote, very competitive, if not a little bit of a savings on premiums, and on at least one of the coverages, a little better coverage. So we have grouped those together, and there is no benefit in bundling as far as pricing, but there is a benefit just administrative. So instead of having three coverages from three different carriers, we have those three coverages from one carrier. So I'll make that change after the meeting. I just wanted to report to both the committee and the board.
Okay. The next thing that we talked about was a recommendation that the change to the sick leave carryover for the employees. They currently are only allowed to carry over, is it 40 hours, Bart?
80
hours of their sick leave from one, unused sick leave from 1 year to the next. And we had talked about the fact that, you know, they do have a long-term disability policy that has a 90-day elimination period. So we thought it might be in the best interest of the employees and the association to increase the amount of sick leave that they can roll over from 1 year to the next. With no cap on that, so that they could bank up to the an unlimited bank of sick time. Because if an employee leaves the association, they don't get paid out unused sick time, so it's not really a financial liability, but it's just a protection for the employee, so that should they have some type of catastrophic accident or illness, they would be able to bridge the gap of that 90-day elimination period without having a financial hardship to their family. We also talked about the finalizing the leave of absence policy. It closely mirrors what large employers have in the FMLA and the military leave areas. But because we're not subject to that because of the number of employees, we're just calling it our employee leave of absence policy. So we talked about that. I know we've talked about it in previous board meetings, and I think we've finalized it, right, guys? I mean, this is the final copy, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So it's finally ready for the board to approve it if everyone is in agreement that this is how we want it to read. We also talked about the, we had discussed this at the last board meeting. I think Director Huckabee had mentioned it, but it's an adoption of an education expense reimbursement policy for the employees. So they had, it was drafted up, and it provides employees financial reimbursement up to 75% reimbursement up to a maximum of $5,000 per association fiscal year to reimburse them for expenses in furthering their education, earning certifications, licenses, things like that that are required, you know, not necessarily required, but that will improve their value to the organization. So.
Okay, it does have that limitation on it, because we had somebody who's been going to nursing school because she wants to leave and be a nurse, and we wouldn't want to pay for that at my company.
We do have a limitation, and also it does have to be in regard to something that has to do with their position here at the Guarantee Association. They can't go get trained to be a nurse or a car mechanic or something else like that. And it is at the executive director's discretion whether or not he, in his opinion, that is of value to the organization and to the employee's, you know, position there. So Bart does have discretion there. And, of course, they have to get a passing grade. If they don't pass, then they do have to repay the money. So.
And, Jim, just to make sure, we do have a repayment contract that is part of this policy. The employee would have to remain with the association for 2 years after the reimbursement to not have any repayment responsibility. If they leave within that two-year period, there are different time frames where there's a specific percentages of the reimbursement that they must repay. And that's built into the policy as well. The committee did review it. So I think the appropriateness of the program or the course that is being taken, the types of tuition, books, testing fees is all defined in there. And to make sure it's appropriate is pretty well addressed.
Did you say that if they fail a class but they continue to work there for 2 years, they don't have to pay back?
No, they have to have a passing grade to actually get the reimbursement. They have to stay for 2 years from the date we reimburse them to not have any responsibility to reimburse.
Okay, to pay back. Okay.
Right. So once they get the reimbursement, they have to stay a full 2 years, and then if they leave, they don't have to repay anything. But if they leave within the two-year period, there's different time frames and percentages of that reimbursement that they have to repay.
We also,
this is Pat.
Oh. Okay, we also added that we would include testing fees, because a lot of times with many professional designations or certifications, you know, the cost of the course is one thing, but then the cost to actually take the exam can be pretty significant as well. So we do include testing fees in that tuition reimbursement policy.
I think, Patty, did I hear?
Oh, I was just going to make a comment that, you know, I think this is very similar to what a policy that my company has. And I think it's pretty common with larger employers. And to the extent our Guarantee Association is small, I still consider it appropriate because, one, I'm just telling you my opinion about it. I think that it's a good employee retention device, and our work that we do at the association is so complex. I think that anything we do to help keep folks there and to help educate them, it's a positive thing for the association. So I think that that's a great idea. So share my opinion about it.
Thank you.
So, Patty, I did report to the committee yesterday. The association has not had a policy like this, but when LaShelle Kaufman and Bowles was managing the association, our firm had one, and we had a couple of employees that took advantage of that. And we saw a definite benefit as they completed courses and took more. One received their undergraduate. Their ability to perform their job, their communications, their letter writing, their report writing, everything significantly was enhanced.
The next item that the personnel committee discussed yesterday was the whistleblower policy. We already had one, but our legal counsel did tweak it for us to keep it more in line with our functions and also to keep it in up to date with all the current laws. So Jackie, did you want to say anything about that before we move on?
don't really have anything to add, Robin. I think, you know, the whistleblower policy we had before was in the section about anti-harassment, and so it was very, very clearly applicable to that that section. And this one is much broader, and it applies to, you know, an employee who might cease, or employee or director or contractor or anybody who might see a you know, something that is a violation of some kind of policy or statute or whatever. So it's more comprehensive than the prior one was.
Yeah, and Robin, may I add, Director Huckabee has suggested, because this whistleblower policy is kind of all-inclusive of all kinds of issues, he suggested we include a workflow schematic of the process that would be used to report and the stages to investigate and then resolve anything reported under the whistleblower policy. So through a couple of meetings, that was developed and refined, and the final schematic is part of the whistleblower policy. And if approved, will go into the employee handbook.
Okay. So in the personnel committee meeting yesterday, we did ask BART to draft a policy regarding employees working remotely, because of course this is a new world that we're all living in and here in 2020. And you know, we, I guess, you know, years ago couldn't have predicted that one day BART and his staff would not be able to work in the office for extended periods of time. So we have asked him to draft a policy regarding that, so that it's not always just on a case-by-case basis and somebody wouldn't be able to come back later and claim that they were treated differently than someone else. So we're going to get a policy in place on that to protect ourselves, and also for the employees to just so that they can understand what those boundaries are while they are out there having to work remotely. So we've added another committee meeting before the board meeting in October, so that we can review that, primarily to review the compensation study and also to prepare any recommended adjustments to the salary ranges or benefits that we feel are warranted that might need to be implemented in 2021. So we'll get that report back from BART. And then also those other things that I just mentioned at that additional personnel committee meeting in October. The last thing was, we conducted the annual review of the personnel committee charter and did not identify any necessary revisions. So that's the report for the personnel committee. So we do have, I guess, some resolutions that we're going to need motions and voting on. The first one would be the resolution on the sick leave carryover limitation. Do we have a motion to approve that?
Ted, so moved.
Second.
Thank you. And now a resolution on the employee leave of absence policy for the Association Employees Handbook to include the medical, military, caregiver, and military service language as recommended by the Personnel Committee. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. And a resolution on an education expense reimbursement policy. It would amend the Employee Handbook to include the education expense reimbursement policy as discussed and recommended by the Personnel Committee. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Who was the first on that?
Summer.
Thank you.
All right. And then a resolution on the whistleblower policy. Again, it amends the employee handbook to revise the whistleblower policy as recommended by the Personnel Committee. Do we have a motion to approve?
Moved.
Second.
Okay. And last but
wait a minute.
Who was the second?
Summer was second.
Thank you.
Okay. And last but not least, the recommendation by the personnel committee that the board accept the proposal and engage Clifton Larson Allen to conduct a compensation and benefit study for the association's employees. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Ted seconds.
Did you tell us how much it cost? I mean, we haven't really had any discussion on it. I don't know if we're paying $150,000 or $10,000.
Give me just a minute. I can tell you. All right, I have so many things up on screen, it takes a minute to find it all.
While we're waiting, could somebody tell me who the second was for the update on the medical caregiver leave, et cetera? Because Huckabee was the first.
I think it was David Summer.
Yeah, I think it was me.
Okay, it's the one voice I'm not getting. I'm sorry.
So I don't know if there's anything that can be done about this, but maybe not having the committee meeting the day before, because we're approving stuff we haven't read. We're just doing it based on recommendations from a committee. I don't know if that's the best way to do things or not.
Jim, I appreciate your concern because there were even some edits that the committee made yesterday. We did some redrafting on the fly, and it would be appropriate to get the final versions in the hands of the committee and the full board in time to read. And you had several different policies here, and it's a lot of material. So you're in essence deferring all the legwork and review and development to the committees. So especially since we're doing video meetings.
I don't mind having them do all of the legwork. That's not but to not even read their final product seems a little strange to be approving it.
Let's say this, Jim, and Jackie, you can jump in after I say this because I know you're going to clean it up. If the board is in any way uncomfortable with taking these actions today, the motions that have been made can be tabled. We can distribute the material and then the board can vote on them at its next meeting. The only thing I am fairly insistent we should move forward with is a compensation study. And I'm pulling the cost for you right now.
I have that, Chair Lewis. The compensation project work, the estimated fee is $5,500. To $7,200, so $5,200 to $7,200. The compensation consultant fee after report is delivered is $225 per hour.
And that was included, James, because I asked them, after you provide your report, we may ask you to attend a committee meeting or a board meeting to take questions and explain issues within your report.
So
that makes sense.
Out-of-pocket travel expense would be billed. Then there's a 5% on top of that that they would charge. So, and as far as the fees, this was probably the most, it was definitely the most comprehensive report. They do have a past relationship in two other different areas with the association. So $5,500 low end to $7,200. Plus the cost for them to come to a board meeting or committee meeting if necessary of $225 an hour.
That sounds reasonable to me. Does anybody have any discussion on it? I don't have a lot of experience with doing compensation surveys, so I know
that was
also a lot cheaper.
That was the lowest cost.
Yeah, it seems like it was a lot cheaper than when we did it in the past.
Yeah, it was the lowest of the five.
So, Jim, and I'll leave it again. Of those five resolutions that the committee's recommending, four of them are items that could be deferred until October. This fifth one on the engagement of the consulting firm, I'd ask that you take action today.
And if, you know, I'm not making the decisions for the board. We're a board. It's not one person making the decision. If everybody else is okay with approving the changes, then that's why we vote. But it just seemed odd. Again, a long time ago, I guess when we changed a lot of things, we tried to move it to where the we got some of this information in advance.
Right.
And instead, we didn't get it at all this time.
You know, one thing you might do is Bart could email the Clifton Larson proposal so everybody can look at that, as well as these other policies. And at some point, you know, we take a break for 30 minutes or something, so everybody has a chance to at least lay eyes on them, and then decide, you know, if you're comfortable with adopting some of these today, or if you would like more time on them.
I don't see any reason not to defer that. I mean, Bart, Jackie, is there any urgency to the whistleblower, the employee leave? I mean, I think the chair's point is well taken. It would be nice for people to be able to read through them. And I don't know if 30 minutes is, you know, going to be enough. To me, if you want to do it before the next meeting, you could have another virtual meeting just to address these specific resolutions. But also, Bart, how long will it take them to do the comp study?
We've asked them to deliver their report in a date in September. I'd have to look at the RFP. I have it sitting here.
But you wouldn't make any adjustments?
No.
in connection with the normal schedule of looking at people's salary in January?
That's what I was targeting, that if we could get this information provided, trying to get to their study.
So I would add that it's one thing to go ahead and approve a compensation study, but to change company policy without actually having read it just seems a little bit odd.
I'll take that responsibility for not getting this out into the hands of the committee. And I'll tell you, I can't send it right now because there were some tweaks from yesterday that I don't have in those various policies. So they're not ready to be distributed. So I would ask the makers of those first four motions, because nothing there is very time sensitive. We could take action in October. If they would allow those first four motions to be tabled and reconsidered at the October meeting.
Do we need to make a motion for us to vote on tabling, or how do we handle that, Bart?
I think what you can do is you can either the person who made the motion can withdraw their motions, or I think you can just sort of do it by, you know, acclamation. Everybody agrees to withdraw all those motions.
I agree. I think I seconded it at one point.
I agree to withdraw them.
Okay, and on the last item, engagement of the consulting firm, I can forward that proposal immediately to the board if they'd like to see that proposal. I will say that James Huckabee's description of the compensation was spot on. I just looked at the proposal, so.
I'm fine with just approving it, but again, to me, that's engaging somebody. That's not changing our policy.
Right.
So do we have a motion on that one already? Should we vote on that one?
Motion on the table. And just ready if someone would like to call the question.
Well, do we want to, does anybody have anything they want to discuss about the compensation consulting?
No.
Okay, moving forward with that, the vote.
Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? Thank you very much.
Jackie, do you have good notes there to assist us on the tabling of the first four and resurrecting those back in October?
Yeah, what I don't have though is who actually made the motion and the second on the compensation committee thing, so, or compensation engagement. So as long as Topping has that, we're fine.
Huckabee first, Kennedy second.
Okay. All right.
Hey, Bart, before we move on, we do have one participant that we need to identify that has joined the meeting. It's phone number 512-712-2387.
No, I can't hear you. You're unmuted, but I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, no, I can hear you, Jarrett.
Can hear you, Jarrett. We can't hear the person who dialed in.
The number 2387?
Correct. Ends in 2387.
Whoever that person is might be able to use the chat function to say what their name is and who they're associated with until their audio works.
I don't know if calling in you have access to
that. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, they're calling in. Not.
Well, we will
try star six. Open.
I don't have that individual. Listen, you were reading my notes.
Jackie or Shelby, it's an open meeting. Do we really need to know except when we go into executive session?
Yeah, I don't think we really need to know, Jim. It's always nice to know.
Okay. Yeah.
When we get to executive session, I can disconnect the person, so we'll be fine there.
Okay.
So, Bart, this is Patty. I mean, I just think we should make it clear that anyone is welcome to attend these meetings at any time because they're fully public. And to the extent we go into executive session, we may have to disconnect them, but they're welcome. I don't know how, when it's virtual, they would know to call back in, but at a certain point, they can be let in. I think with Zoom, you can have a waiting room, right? And then let them back in. Okay, so whoever is attending, just, you know, to make it clear that they're welcome to call back in and be in the waiting room when we're in executive session.
And that person at 2387, you can always email me or email Topping if you're in any way uncomfortable disclosing your identity through our recorded meeting. Okay, Jim, we're ready to move
forward. Okay, so we're moving on to item number five, which is the Assessment Investment Committee.
Yeah, so this is Jim Harrison. The committee met yesterday afternoon. All members were present. The committee reviewed the cash flow projections of obligations and expenses. The association's obligations have remained pretty much unchanged. We have adequate funds to meet all our obligations. There are no kind of Class B assessment necessary. The committee received a report from Bart and Jarrett on the association's current investments. The committee did not identify any necessary changes. The committee reviewed the association's investment policy and the committee charter. These are annual requirements. The staff did not recommend any changes to either document, and neither did committee members. And then lastly, we spent most of our time reviewing some items related to the recent Class A assessment. We're gonna have a couple of action items related to that Class A. I think I'm going to turn it over to Bart, if I could. Maybe you think you're better positioned to kind of run down the issues with that assessment, Bart, and then we can jump to the two resolutions after that.
Okay. Let's begin with this. First, we did have a couple of companies contact us, actually several, asked for some extensions of time and some waiver of penalties because of the COVID-19 situation. And all the companies were provided with the same response, which is no. Statute requires we provide 30 days notice from distribution of the assessment to the collection date and the due date. We mailed the assessment March 9th, and the due date was April 30th, 7 weeks later. So we felt that this was adequate notice and no special exceptions were granted in response to the COVID-19. And after providing the explanation of the companies, the issue disappeared. Second issue had to do with data and two changes here, all stemming from the legislative change that took effect September 1st, 2019. One, we have 71 new members of the association being the HMO members. And although not all those members received assessment for this Class A, because not all those members have assessable premium, but several of them did question the appropriateness of the assessable premium used to calculate their assessment. This stemmed from another change that was implemented as part of that legislative change, and that is the exclusion of Medicaid premiums. But not only Medicaid, but also the Medicaid premiums that are derived or support the Texas Children's Health Insurance Program, the CHIP program. We are the only state that has an exclusion for CHIP. We did understand from the Model Act Revision Group at the NEIC, which is chaired by James Kennedy, that the intention was to exclude all Medicaid premiums from Guaranty Association assessable premiums. But the Model Act Revision Group just did not get to the CHIP component. And if you look at the Model Act, the description of the various titles that are tied to Medicaid, it does not include the CHIP or the title that CHIP falls under. So in the Texas statute, the specific work was done to make sure all Medicaid premium and the CHIP component of that is excluded as assessable premium. So a couple of the HMO companies challenged and said, it should be excluded. Why are you assessing me on this? Well, first we had to use 2018 premium to do the assessment in March of 2019, because 2019 premium had not been reported yet. And actually, we still don't have 2019 premium. We won't get it until October. Okay, so we used 2018 premium. When HMOs, when the 2018 premium was collected, HMOs were not part of the Guaranty Association. They joined until September 1st, 2019. So to go back in 2000, get the 2018 premium, it took some work. Through NOLGA and through the association and TDI, we got those premiums. But of course, the HMOs had not done any of the Guaranty Association-based reconciliation filing and adjustments on what is assessable premium. So only Schedule T and certain adjustments that we could find in the annual statement on the exhibit of premiums, enrollment, and utilization, where Medicaid is identified, were deducted. The problem is CHIP is not broken out on that schedule. So it was a combination of the timing of the changes to the law, the timing of the assessment, and the availability of data that led to this problem. We now have been able to identify for the four HMOs that raised this issue that yes, those are CHIP premiums, thanks to TDI for assisting us with that, and they should be excluded. So the one thing we don't yet know is, have we identified all the companies that had CHIP premiums? And the committee has specifically given some instructions to how to continue with that research. But just to let you know, those four companies that had an assessment, Class A assessment, and because of their CHIP premiums, that assessment should not have been levied. The assessments totaled $9,789.84. Two of the companies have not paid, and two of the companies have paid. So the committee will have a recommendation for you to consider on the handling of those CHIP premiums. If I can go ahead and just, do you want to tackle that, Jim? Let me report on the other past dues, or how would you like to do this?
Yeah, why don't we go ahead since you've just talked about the CHIP. So as Bart mentioned, there are four companies. The premiums we're talking about are pretty small, under $10,000 combined. As he noted, two have paid, two have not paid. It's clear that CHIP premiums are not assessable premium. So what we decided was, I guess, reflected on this the resolution that Bart has up now. So under A, we reimburse those member companies that have paid, and there are two of them, as Bart mentioned, that have, or are later identified as having paid, and this goes to the research Bart's going to do to see if any other companies beyond the four have paid an assessment based on, in part upon CHIP premium. So we'd refund those. We would not pursue payment from any member companies that have not yet paid. As Bart said, two of the four haven't yet paid. And then C is report to the committee at its next meeting in January 2021 about how to address any shortfall. So we'll know that there'll be a shortfall in the assessment, at least $9,700 and change for the four we've already identified, or Bart's already identified. And you know, we'll see if there's any more that have paid based on CHIP premium. At that time, we'll have a firm grasp of the numbers and we'll decide if there's anything that we should do to address the shortfall. So hopefully I adequately explain the resolution. The committee members, Ted or Dean, if you have anything else to add.
I think that sums it up perfectly.
This is Patty. I have a comment too that might be helpful. But I could wait until after we're done with the resolution or, but the CHIP premiums are, HHSC publishes financial statistical reports for all participating Medicaid and CHIP plans in Texas. And they do, those reports do include total premiums for CHIP on the HHSC website. So I could share that. I mean, that might make it easier in the future.
Yes.
Because they do report out those very detailed financial statements publicly on that state agency's website that contracts with the plans for administration of those programs. So I can send the link to BART, but it specifically has CHIP premium for 2019 for each of those. Okay, I'll send it to you.
I did look at the Health and Human Services website to see all the plans that participate in the CHIP program. And it lists plans, not insurance companies. So it's kind of hard to identify. So that report would be helpful. But if we could look at that and digest it, and then we'll be working with John Alexander and John Peters at the TDI. And if we need clarification, I think TDI could assist us by requesting additional information from Health and Human Services to help identify those premiums. So that's part of the process we're going to do. But Patty, your help would be significantly beneficial because this is a little, this is a new area for us.
Okay. I'm happy to help. I'll send you the link. And it's not real easy to find. You have to know exactly what to Google to find where it is.
I'm glad. I mean, looked around.
I'm a Google person. So it specifically references financial statistical reports. So that's not normally a... Anyway, I'll send you the link, Bart, but that might help in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patty. No other questions. I'd entertain a motion, or my place is to solicit one. But
just Ted, I move.
Ted's number one. We have a second.
Second.
That's Wendy Karsten. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
And then we had one other resolution as well. The association received a request from four member companies for deferral of the assessment. These four companies were placed in rehabilitation, and the rehabilitators have requested deferrals. The four companies and the amounts that would be deferred are specified in the resolution there at the top of the screen. I think, Bart, you can correct me, but this is fairly routine request in these circumstances, and the committee anyway recommended the attached resolution.
Jim, it's not a correction. You're very correct in what you've said, but a clarification, because there was a unique element here. These are two rehabilitations, Time Insurance Company, II, out of Wisconsin. And then the three companies there are actually in a rehabilitation proceeding for the global companies out of North Carolina, Bankers Life, Colorado Bankers, and Southland National. What's interesting is Time did not pay and asked for deferral. Of the three global companies, one paid. Another there was paid through our process of applying credit refund to the assessment. And the third one, and this is how we got notice of the request for deferral, had not paid and realized there was an assessment due when we started sending past due notices. And I think realized after they finally got the certified letter from us in mid-June. So at that point, they said, on behalf of all three companies, we'd like to ask for a deferral of the assessment. To do that, we would defer the unpaid. And that one that was paid through a credit refund, we would, through accounting, reverse the credit refund and put that balance back on the association's books and carry it. And then refund to the one that had paid the assessment. So a little bit different process, but all would be treated the same, would be carried as a deferred and unpaid assessment.
They really asked for a deferral of $2.79.
They did. Okay, they did.
Oh, they probably spent 50 cents on a postage stamp.
I spent more than that just explaining it.
So do we have, anybody want to make a motion?
This is Ted, I'll move the resolution.
This is Robin, I'll second.
Okay, any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? Thank you very much.
That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Jim, if I could.
Sure.
It's a reporting item, just the status on the few remaining unpaid Class A assessments and the action the association will take. So as of yesterday, we advised the committee there were still 11 companies that not paid their March 2020 Class A assessment. Two of those were some of the chip companies we just talked about. So nine companies had not paid. Three companies paid yesterday. So now there are only six. Those six companies have not paid owe a total of $4,593.19. Prior direction from the board asked that I follow the statutory guidance and report or refer these unpaid assessments to Commissioner Sullivan and copy my letter to each company so they know they've been referred to the commissioner for collection. So we're gonna send six individual letters to the commissioner with involving each one of those companies, and then a summary letter to the commissioner. Okay, in summary, these six companies owe X, and here are the individual letters. That way we can then take the individual letters and send it to the companies without one company knowing another one is past due. So we will implement that right after this meeting, but wanted to make sure we reported to the committee and the board before taking that action. And I do want to commend the TDI for helping us. We had a call in mid-June and went over the past due assessments at that point. There was some, almost 30 companies.
Yeah, we sent TDI 24 companies, and we have now whittled that down to 6 with their help.
Yeah, so TDI was good that they involved the analysts assigned to the companies and sent some emails and helped us collect those outstanding assessments. So the number of companies being actually referred to the commissioner are much reduced due to their help with this matter. So thanks to John and John for doing that.
And Bart?
Yes.
This you know, all the credit goes to the individual analysts that handled those inquiries. They were very prompt, very stayed on top of it. So kudos to them.
Great. And Chair Harrison, that's my last reporting item for the Assessment Investment Committee.
I don't have anything else either.
Anybody have any questions before we move on? Okay, then number 6 is executive session. Anybody have anything before we go to executive session? Okay, so the time is 9:29 a.m. on July 21st, 2020, and I am recessing the regular session of the Board of Directors meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association in order for the board to meet in executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. The time is 11:47. Oh, are you ready?
Can hear you talk.
We are recording in public session.
Okay, the time is 11:47 a.m. on July 21st, 2020. The executive session of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association Board of Directors meeting has concluded, and I am reconvening the regular session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. And I think that
before we jump into the next thing, Jim, with your permission, I'd just like to note for purposes of our recording that, you know, we did have a visitor on the first part of the meeting associated with the phone number 512-712-2387. And we were not able to, you know, determine who that visitor was and with whom they were associated, even though they were asked to identify themselves. And so when we started in executive session, that visitor was placed in the waiting room and the call was locked so that nobody else could call in during executive session. So now that we're back in open session, if that person is still in the waiting room, they can be readmitted. And if not, then that's all right too.
Thank you, Jackie. And I did look and I do not show anyone in the waiting room.
Okay, and for item 7, we don't have anything that we need to discuss. I mean, that requires action because of executive session, right?
Correct.
Then we're on to Bart's quarterly report.
Okay. Hopefully everyone can see my screen that I'm sharing. Quick summary of where we are, and just a few comments from me on my quarterly report. We're continuing to work on redrafting the policy procedure manual, the new format that we'd shown you back in January. And a couple of tweaks to the business continuity plan. Always, as we change systems and processes, we update that. With the phone system change, which I got a notification during the meeting, several of the numbers have now ported. We'll need to make some tweaks there. So that's a living document. We're continually changing, but the big project is a policy procedure manual because we're adopting a much more user-friendly format. But that work is slow. Doing this remotely in the COVID world is a little difficult, but we are working on it. Office lease, our space will expire in our downtown office May 31st of next year. I had been scheduled on May 12th to visit some other offices. I had reviewed about 30 different properties and narrowed it to, I think, 11. I put that on hold. I didn't want to go visit properties in the COVID world, and I'm kind of glad I did because it now looks like the opportunities have gotten a little better and the pricing has improved because a lot of offices are saying we don't need offices. in our search, we did reduce our space needs significantly to cut back on our large boardroom and some of our other offices. But I will say this, I don't believe the association can work and function fully, totally in a virtual world. We will need some type of physical office. So we are going to proceed with that format. I will wait a little bit longer and then resurrect our search and start looking at properties. It's just right now, with the peak of the COVID exposure in Austin, I'm not comfortable going and visiting a bunch of offices. Quick update on some meetings. NEIC meeting, many of you are involved in that. The summer national meeting that's about to be held is going to be held over a 3-week period. I've registered for it. It's at a reduced rate because there are several committee meetings I would like to attend and task force meetings, and I have been able to work them around some of the other schedule. It is a reduced rate instead of the $7.95. I think it's $4.95 to register for that meeting. So I will be attending a big chunk of that. NOLGA's legal seminar will take place July 29th, 30th, and 31st, and that's going to be held virtually. And I know several of you are registered to attend, Jackie, Jarrett, myself, Shelby. NOLGA's put a lot of effort into this, and they've engaged an outside firm to handle the virtual aspect of it. So I'm anticipating that this will be exemplary. Welcome back, James and Patty. Thank you for joining us. So that legal seminar will be coming up. And James, I'm glad you came back. I mentioned legal seminar. I think you're presenting at the NOLGA legal seminar, if I understand. And after that, on the 5th and 6th of August, NOLGA will be having over 2 afternoons, our MPC meeting, handling a lot of our normal insolvency presentations. I'm doing a couple presentations there for one of my task forces, and then I chaired a committee to work up the virtual best practices for the Guaranty Association system. So how we do MPC meetings, how we do task force and committee meetings. I also did that for IAIR as well, and James was involved in some of that. So you'll hear me do a little describing of the process we went through and what we recommend as best practices for virtually meeting. And then the future NOLGA meetings that were scheduled to be October 26th and 28th in the JW Marriott, Nashville. No decision has been made yet, but I think the sentiment is leaning toward virtual meetings. So stay tuned. I'll let you know how the annual meeting and the NPC meeting for NOLGA will shape up. And that's all I have on the executive director report, unless there's any questions. Continue, Jim.
Yeah. This is moving on to item number 9, the state summary.
I'll provide a quick summary of where we are on some of our active receivership estates and then move into a couple of key ones. There are going to be one or two action items that have just recently developed, so I may not have resolutions in the book for you to consider. So you can see here are the active receivership estates that we're involved with. These are the open receiverships. We still have obligations on some older closed insolvencies that may not be on this list, but what we see is there are 22 active estates, and then the 7 here at the bottom of the page that we're monitoring that could, right now in rehabilitation at some point, be liquidations. Then we have, as of May 31st, $3.39 million of aggregate forecasted obligations, as you see for these 6 insolvencies. Some of them are quite old, and some of them are newer. But this is what we have recorded as aggregate liabilities, and I do segregate them between short-term and the next 12 months and outside of 12 months. Here's a summary of our communications activity for the second quarter of 2020. As you can see, we've had 381 phone calls on active companies. 4 were referred by TDI, 20 actually on insolvencies, 267 miscellaneous, so 673 total calls. The calls are down a little bit. One thing we're doing is we're accumulating a quarterly summary of some of our TDI calls, but we're getting referrals from TDI that are blind referrals. Nita will answer the phone and someone is on the phone and they've been transferred by TDI with no announcement. And we have no reason why they're calling. One recent one had complained about the handling of a claim by their insurance company. Why it was referred from TDI to the Guaranty Association, I do not know, because it was an active insurance company. But we try to respond to consumers and provide them any information at our disposal. That's a little bit limited now because some of the information from TDI, primarily the ICANN system for researching company histories and transactions, is no longer publicly available. Just so you're aware, I've asked that be resurrected several times with TDI, and security concerns are kind of raised to the fore, and I don't know that will ever change. And here at the bottom of the page, you'll see our website visitors and activities. We do get email inquiries through our website and also through the NOGL website. Topping and I respond to all of those, and we kind of divvy up whether Topping wants me to handle an issue or she just takes care of it. But we do make sure we're very prompt in returning both calls and email requests. Moving on to specific insolvencies here. Penn Treaty, the largest health insurance insolvency faced by the Guaranty Association and the Guaranty Association system nationally. You can see here our admin expenses through May, our reinsurance payments to the captive that we own along with 44 other Guaranty Associations, LTC Reinsurance Company. And then you can see net, we've had $110 million of expenses. We did assess and collect $130 million. So we still have money that we're working with. Where we are administratively, I chair the Policy and Claims Administration Working Group, PACA, we call it, for the Guaranty Association system. I do a monthly report, and I have for the Guaranty Association since the liquidation started. So what I'm showing here are some recent numbers as of May 31st. I didn't put in June because at the time of this report, I hadn't received the June reports. I've now done those, but here it is, the end of May. Collected premiums, a little over $300 million for all the Guaranty Associations, $831 million in paid claims. You need to add to that $117 million in payments here for the cash buyouts under the rate increase program. So about $950 million in benefits paid. We now have 49,000 enforced policies and 5,600 open claims. Then here on the right, you see the number for Texas, 17 million premium, 40 million in claims, 2,600 enforced policies and 416 open and pending claims. So the big effort right now in Penn Treaty has been conversion. This is where the business is being converted from the administration platform at Penn Treaty that we had used since the liquidation began to the administration platform of the new TPA that we identified through an RFP process. And they took over administration, that's TriPlus Services, Inc., on October 1st of 2019. They submitted a conversion statement of work that the conversion oversight group, which I serve on, approved. And it is to convert all the business to the new platform by October 1st, 2021. There are four stages to that conversion. First is to convert the New York company, AINIC, first. And it is a company that is controlled by Penn Treaty, so part of the receivership assets, but is not in liquidation and has no Guaranty Association protection. Convert it first and use it kind of a sounding board in a test case. That was fully converted and went live on May 1st. No issues were found. So now we moved on to the three phases that involve policies protected by the Guaranty Associations. The ANIC, American Network Insurance Company, long-term care business is being converted now. It's targeted to go live on November 1st. And then next will be the Penn Treaty long-term care business, followed by the Penn Treaty and ANIC non-long-term care business, about 1,000 of scattered health insurance policies. everything is being completed by April 1st. I receive twice a month, I participate in the conversion oversight group's monitoring of that status, and everything is on track. We have a very detailed timeline, and it's working well. As part of the conversion, TriPlus came up with a number of processes through their process re-engineering review that they would like to change as part of the administration. So as in that, the PACA group has the authority to review and approve those process changes. So TriPlus worked up a list and submitted it to PACA. I reviewed that with TriPlus and the COO of LTC RE, Jody Anatole. And I recommended we put these into the three categories you see on the screen here of proposed changes. There were some that was just very perfunctory, changing from a specific process that is in the PIN treaty system that works better with the system, admin system at TriPlus. That's an admin system called CAPS. Not a lot to go over there, but there are 9 detailed processes. And we sent those out under an email with an email description and asked the PACA members vote accept, reject, or send a request as I want to talk about this, let's have a call. Ended up, we did have a call on several of the items. You would think going from the premium billing statements in PIN Treaty to the premium billing statements in CAPS would be very straightforward. There were suggested changes, and then PACA suggested even more changes. One of the things I said is it's ridiculous to tell a policyholder your policy is going to lapse in 53 days. Policyholders are not going to count 53 days. And the lapse period here, there is a 65-day period. The system has a date. Just put a date in there. Your policy is going to lapse on X. Let's tell them. So they seem pretty straightforward, but good changes and improved a lot of the processes for the consumers. Group 2 were more complex. Had some legal and actuarial perspectives that we had to put in there. All but one of those were accepted by PACA. One was rejected that we said, let's stay with the current process. And then the last 4 were very, very detailed, long, multiple hour video conferences to go over some process changes. So all of this was conducted from May 20th through June 24th. As I said in the report, 70 pages of supporting documents, 7 video conferences, a lot of work. I drafted the report to the CNS committee to let them know what we believe is an appropriate decision to seek their feedback. We had a CNS committee call on July 7th. I also serve on CNS. And CNS accepted all the recommendations and decisions that PACA made. Did have some substantial questions. It was not just a rubber stamp call, but they supported all of our decisions. So that was a huge, huge step in the conversion and a lot of work, but it's behind us now. So that was a good thing. COVID, TriPlus is operating without missing a beat in the COVID world, and everything is working very, very well. So they have not only backup and redundancy, but between their offices in Allentown, Connecticut, and also in Omaha, Nebraska, everything is well covered. And if there were a flare up in any one area, another area could cover it very well. So they have teams that go into the Allentown offices and they rotate and they're distanced within the offices and they're wearing masks the entire time because some of the things have to be done in person, but it's working very, very well and no problems. Quick summary on the rate increases. 57,969 packages have been mailed. 40,000 policyholders accepted the rate increase or by no response were given the rate increase. 8,000 benefit reduction, 1,300 RPUs, and 5,200 elected the cash buyout. So these are the percentages of how that all worked out. I think this is what's really important. Only 17,000 policyholders have called in response to the packages that were mailed to 57,000. 84 complaints out of 57,000. I think we did a decent job of explaining it and working through the rate increase. I will say the last 2 states, Pennsylvania was approved during the COVID process, but the implementation was postponed until it got a little more stable and controlled. It is now being implemented. And just last week, New Hampshire, who had previously said no to the rate increase, reconsidered and has approved the rate increase. So now we have not 46, we have 48 states that have approved. So a very, very good result. And the last thing, this is important. A year ago, we implemented a process that monthly we reported to me how many Guaranty Association covered policies have reached at least 75% of their statutory GA limit. And we now, as of May 31st, policies in 32 states have hit at least 75% of the Guaranty Association limit. 166 of those have fully exhausted their coverage. And in Texas, we only have 12 policies that have hit the 75% level and four have exhausted it. I don't have it here to chart. I do provide it to through PACA to LTC Re, how that has progressed in the last year. But and now that we're 3.5 years in the rehab plan, Guaranty Association coverage limits are being hit. And it's getting much, much higher number. So that's an area we'll continue to watch. Because once those consumers hit the limit, whether it be 300,000 or then we still had two states in this insolvency at 100,000. We even have in California, it has 560 something thousand dollar limit. We have some that are getting close to limits there, but it's something we do track. Okay, that was Penn Treaty. These others will go quicker. Lincoln Memorial, moving along, and the key here is we've paid out $37 million in direct benefits, $25 million in expenses, and one $95 million, well, actually two assumptions. One of those was $94 million, the other was $1 million. So we've paid out quite a bit, but recovered $45 million to date. So our net cost is $96 million, and we've assessed $114. We only have 49 policies left in force being administered by the receiver. And there are discussions as the receiver is possibly moving to close the receivership if the litigation proceeds a little quicker. How should those policies be administered? We only have 49, but there's still about 5,000 or so across the country and other states. So a lot of options are being explored. And Jackie has already given you a summary of the asset recovery litigation. All right, Universal Life. For Texas, this is a small insolvency out of Alabama. It is bigger for some other states. Alabama and Tennessee have a significant exposure in this, along with its sister company, Booker T. Washington, which was not licensed in Texas. We haven't paid a lot, but the problem is there are thousands of policies. There are over 100,000 policies nationally. We only have addresses for about 30,000 of them. So a lot of research is conducted when people call and consumers looking for policies and potentially paid up policies that have been stuck in this company for a long time. Insurance Administrative Solutions has been administering this for the Guaranty Associations, and they have recently told us that they would like to terminate their administrative agreement with us. They're moving out of the administration of life policies and going to move more into Medicare Supplement Administration only. So the task force has been working and found through an RFP process, another TPA called Actuarial Management Resources, AMR. And there's going to be a flat cost of $30,000 a month, which is about $6,000 less a month than we're paying IAS, and a transition fee of $25,000. That it's in process of being developed. An agreement is close to being finalized. It's hopeful that the first week of August that it will be ready for the MPC to sign off on and do a 30-day opt-out process. I have not included a resolution here because I didn't know if we were going to be ready to consider this in August, but I would ask the board for authority to participate, for me to execute whatever documents are necessary to participate in this service agreement with Actuarial Management Resources. And I'll pause there, Jim, to see if anyone wants to tackle that.
Yeah, this is Dean. I'll make that motion.
Thank you, Dean.
Was that Jim Buckley? That was Jim Harrison.
Okay.
Frigo Harrison, thank you.
Any discussion? All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Aye. Anybody
opposed? Anyone opposed? Thank you very much.
Okay, last one. Northwestern National Insurance Company, property and casualty company that had written some very, very old health insurance policies back in early 70s, kind of before the days of Major Medical. Very comprehensive, cover a lot of things, and they have some unique wrinkles in the administration of the benefits. We have been lucky that one of the former Northwestern National employees had been hired by the receiver that we had engaged as an administrator here to handle the remaining policies. There were only 63 nationally, two in Texas. We did send out buyout offers along with the other guarantee association to try to buy out these policyholders. Neither of the Texas policyholders were interested. We didn't hear from either one of them, although one of the policyholders stopped paying their premiums and it lapsed. So we have one Texas policyholder left. The receiver is ready to stop doing in this administration, advise the guarantee associations, and the task force has been working on an administrative solution. What we've been able to come up with is the Illinois Guarantee Association has a claims administration system that they have offered that we license, we'd be offered the opportunity to enter into a licensing agreement to use their system and put in our own information, and they will provide some consulting resources on the management of the claims. But we would put everything into the system so the Texas Guarantee Association staff would be posting the collection of the premium, corresponding with the policyholders, and doing everything but doing the adjudication of the benefits. But then we would control the posting and distribution of EOBs. So I just yesterday received the draft of the licensing agreement and another document to allow us to enter into that administrative solution. It's really the only option available to us. Jackie's reviewing those agreements. Topping Jarrett and I had a call with the former employee of Northwestern National to talk with her about the administration of the policies, and it was difficult. We were not on the same page, and a lot of missing pieces. We did work with the task force and asked that some claims be administered by that consultant and by the consultants working with the Illinois Guarantee Association system to independently adjudicate claims and compare results, and they came out identical. So we think this is a reasonable solution for the one remaining Texas policyholder. This also allows us to keep the prescription drug card going, and that's predominantly what the claims we see from this one policyholder is, about $10,000 a quarter in prescription drug claims. So I recommend that we, or I'm going to request the authority to enter into the necessary documentation to utilize the Illinois Guarantee Association administration system to allow the Texas Guarantee Association's employees to administer this loan remaining policy. And if you have any questions about claim volume or admin cost, I would defer to Jarrett. He's been very involved in this one.
Yeah, this is Dean. I'll make that motion.
Thank you, Dean.
James Huckabee will second.
Anybody want to discuss it? Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Anyone opposed? Thank you very much.
And Jim, thank you. That is all I have on the insolvencies.
Okay, then on to item number 10.
Okay, on the corporate governance issues, two small items. Many of you have already fulfilled your responsibilities and filed your personal financial statements with the Texas Ethics Commission. I don't receive that from the Ethics Commission, but some of you have told me you've already filed, so thank you. For those that you have not, July 31st is the new deadline. It was extended from April 30th to July 31st this year. Please file your personal financial statements. If you have questions, contact the Ethics Commission, or if you need a contact there, I can provide you with a name and number. Second, at the time of the last board meeting, we still had a handful of the antitrust certifications and the conflict of interest business ethics questionnaires outstanding. Those have all now been collected, and I have reviewed them, and there was no issues identified that would require any action or follow-up. And Jim, that's all I have on item 10.
Okay, on to item 11, 990.
Okay, so the association is required to file its Form 990, the return of organization exempt from income tax annually. And the process is Jarrett assembles the 990. He sends it to the outside CPA firm. They run it through their form checker to make sure no conflicts come up and if they have any questions. Then we prepare the draft and post it confidentially for the board to review prior to this July meeting. The guidelines of the 990 do not require board approval of the 990, but there is a specific question that we have to certify that the 990 was provided for review by the governing body of the entity. So I posted the 990 in a confidential Dropbox for all the members to review. And if you have questions, we'll be glad to take those at this time.
Bart, can I add something real quick?
You sure can.
So this is the first year that the 990 is required to be filed electronically for the GA. And so the form is a little different than prior years because it is on the CPA's format. And I do recognize there were a few typos that will be corrected before it is filed.
And Jim, this is just to see if the board has any questions.
Anybody? Okay, then item number 12.
Okay, let me move to the financials here. Jarrett, could you take just a minute and explain the change in the cash from April to May and then how that does get reflected, I think, down in our, let me get to it.
Yeah, so in,
right here,
we distributed the assessment in March. So you'll see that on the statement of activities and changes in net position in the next page. And so as we, so right there from at the March, you'll see the almost $3 million of the assessment. And the difference between that and the 2.3 that the board authorized are the assessments that are under $5 that we don't send out for administrative purposes. So back to the balance sheet, we sent that out in March. And as we started collecting them, we started building up cash. And so in May, we took that, as we collected most of the assessment, we took that cash and bought treasuries. Following the investment policy and the maturity schedule that the AI committee has given us. And so you'll see in May, the treasury bills jumped up quite a bit because of the cash that we took and bought treasuries. And then on the line for the billed assessments net of allowance, you'll see starting in March where the receivable for the assessment was booked. And then over the months, it slowly is being reduced as we start collecting those assessments.
And there are no other really significant changes in the financials. So you can see where you are in a net asset position, about $47 million. Jerry, is there anything else in the financials you feel like you should need to point out here?
No, sir. Other than that, the quarter's been really, really slow and quiet.
Okay. A couple other financial matters. I'll go back here. The GASB pronouncement, Jared had reported in the last board meeting that we would be implementing GASB 87, and you should see its impact in the financial statements as of the end of May that we will present in this meeting. Because of COVID-19, right here on May 8th, GASB came out with a new statement postponing the effective dates of certain authoritative guidance. In that, they have postponed the implementation of GASB 87, and they've not even released the guidance on how to implement it. So with that postponement, we have not implemented GASB 87, and it involves the reflection of, doesn't it capitalize leases, Jared, is that correct?
That's correct, treats leases as a capital asset.
So we don't have that many leases, but we do have some. Just to let you know, we are following the GASB pronouncements, and we thought it was important to tell you here, since we had previously reported we would implement it, we're not implementing it. So as soon as guidance comes out from GASB and they come out with a new date by which it should be implemented, we will do so. Okay, tax reporting. There was a tax law change that required the parking paid by the association for employees that it could, is no longer be treated as an expense. And I think, Jared, it kind of throws it in the fringe benefit categories. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So in 2018 and 2019 tax years, we ended up paying a tax on that. And that's the approximately $2,500 a year. So Jared went through that process. File the tax returns, pay the taxes, and then there was a change in the tax law this year that repealed that treatment of the parking paid by employees. So amended returns were filed, and I think there it is, Jarrett, on April 14th, you got back two refunds, correct?
We got one refund on April 14th. For the 2018 tax that we paid, plus a little interest. And then on May 6th, we got the 2019 tax we paid as a refund. And because it's within the same tax year, there was no interest on that one.
So it's not a lot of money, but we do want to keep you advised. We do cross the I's and dot the I's and cross the T's here. So Jim, that's all we have on the financial matters, unless there are questions.
So October 20th is the next scheduled meeting. Does anybody know if they have a conflict with that?
And Jim, I'm going to say it now. We're moving forward to go ahead and schedule that as a video conference.
Yeah, I think you should.
In light of COVID, there's no sense in trying to do it in person and having to change. We're just going to right now tell you it'll be a video audio conference.
Well, if we're lucky, we'll have some kind of vaccine and maybe be able to meet in April.
Can I ask this? If any board member looks at their schedules and identifies that they may have a conflict, let me know. And we can always communicate via email if we need to make any adjustment or try to adjustment that scheduling. But right now, it's Tuesday, October 20th, same time, 8:30 a.m.
Well, does anybody else have something they want to discuss? I think that's it on our agenda. So all right to end things. Okay, then the time is 12:25 p.m. on July 21st, 2020. And this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association that has been held pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act is adjourned. Thank you, everybody.